yourselves together. Right. Stand up and live your life. Right. Glenn Greenwald. I continue to find it genuinely bizarre that wealthy and well-connected media pundits and DC operatives log onto Twitter or go on cable news on a daily basis to scream at young, debt-ridden, working class, and or lower income people that they are privileged for not cheering Biden. The privileged pundits that we're going to poke today don't give a shit about actual working people. They'd probably be happier if the working people just stayed home and didn't vote at all. They know that older voters are the ones they have to persuade. They know that older voters are the ones they have to scare into voting against Donald Trump. They don't actually care, though, if Donald Trump loses. What they really care about is keeping their gig flow going. But the latest trick up their sleeve is using vote shaming to shame the comfortable voters who typically vote in primary elections. They're trying to say that anyone who won't vote Biden against Donald Trump is privileged. What a crock of shit. For one thing, they're totally privileged. And for another thing, the reason that people don't vote for Biden is because they're desperate for change. They're the opposite of privileged. But those who are willing to vote for change who are not desperate still seem to be too easily snookered by these MSDNC pundit types. They all understand why Bernie Sanders is such a threat, because he would upset the status quo. He would upset their gig flow. He would bring real hope and change instead of what the lying con man Barack Obama actually brought. The people I'm discussing with you today are craven grifters. We need to expose them for what they are: sneering, condescending assholes. Here's a tweet from Jennifer Rubin. It is not worthwhile to court Sanders or his rabid allies. Indeed, it is far better to ignore them, clearly position Biden in the center left, like you're going to position him. You go ahead, Jennifer. You just position that empty husk of a politician wherever you want him, in the center left, which really means right wing as you can get. Be free to construct a cohesive administration and help clear the decks for a new group of responsible progressives. Responsible like you, right, Jennifer? Meaning you know how to suck up to power and you'll do whatever the powerful want you to do. Neera understands the comfy Democrat. As I've said, the big challenge for Sanders has been that Dems want to unite to fight Trump. But as he's behind, his only option is to attack Biden, which makes Dem voters want to end this faster. It's a bind that it's hard to see how he gets out of. Well, you got that right. The powerful have bound him, and you are their sock puppet. The only way to show people the truth about what's going on is to attack Biden and Obama and Bill Clinton, none of which give a fuck about working class people. That's what privilege means. But the point we should be making and the message we should be sharing is from Barack Obama is a Harvey Weinstein Democrat. Congratulations to all those who are privileged enough to endorse a return to normalcy, where 68,000 Americans die each year due to lack of health care, 1 in 4 children live in poverty, and life expectancy continues to drop. The only two plausible reasons to vote for Joe Biden are fear and privilege. Black and brown people who would otherwise have voted for Bernie Sanders have been scared into voting for Joe Biden. The older black moms in the South whose preachers told them to vote for Joe Biden because he could defeat Donald Trump. They're genuinely afraid of Donald Trump. And I'm not here to berate them for that. I'm not black. I don't know what it feels like when the police pull me over for no reason. I'm not nagging or blaming anybody on that front. I don't know what it feels like to be you. But I do know we're not going to solve the problems of systemic racism until we figure out a way to bomb the status quo into oblivion. The system needs to be dismantled. Glenn Greenwald says, non-voters are not privileged. They are disproportionately lower income, non-white, and dissatisfied with the two parties. Not even 24 hours have elapsed since Bernie Sanders announced that he was suspending his presidential run, and already a shaming campaign has been launched against those who are contemplating abstaining from voting due to dissatisfaction with the two major party candidates. The premise invoked for this tactic is that only those who are sufficiently privileged have the luxury of choosing not to vote, meaning that non-voters are rich and white and thus largely immune from the harmful consequences of a Trump presidency, which largely falls on the backs of poorer and non-white Americans.
This tactic rests on a caricature. It is designed to suggest that the only people who make a deliberate and conscious choice not to vote due to dissatisfaction are white trust fund leftists whose wealth, status, and privilege immunize them from the consequences of abstention. By contrast, this "you must vote" campaign insists those who lack such luxuries, poorer voters and racial minorities, understand that voting is imperative. This assertion about the identity and motives of non-voters is critical not only to try to bully and coerce people into voting by associating non-voting with rich white privilege, but also to suppress any recognition of how widespread the dissatisfaction is for both parties and the political system generally among poor and non-white citizens.
As Mehdi Hasan said in his Twitter debate with Kyle Kulinski, you can oppose both Trump and Biden, I do, but one of them will end up president. Who would you prefer that to be? Simple question, Biden or Trump? Me, AOC, Bernie, Chomsky, Cornel West all say Biden. What say you, Biden or Trump? There's no option C, sadly. So if you're on the left and have more of a shot at getting at least some of what you want from a Biden admin, what's the holdup? Well, allow me to explain as best I can, and you may or may not agree, but at least you can understand the thinking a little bit better. Look, the biggest innovation of the modern Clintonite Democratic Party hasn't been any particular policy idea or value or principle or method of organizing. No, the real groundbreaking innovation, which was pioneered by Bill Clinton, was screwing over and humiliating the left, preferably in as public a fashion as possible. If you wonder why so many very serious people in DC pride themselves on telling hard truths to the left, this is where that entire ethos comes from. The idea of screwing over your own base was called counter-scheduling during the Clinton years, with perhaps the most famous example being Clinton's so-called Sister Soldier moment. But really, counter-scheduling was the most consistent value and through line of Clinton's time in office. As the great Thomas Frank explained in the great book, Listen Liberal, during the 1992 race, as though to compensate for his Fred the Little Guy economic theme, Clinton would confront and deliberately antagonize certain elements of the Democratic Party's traditional base in order to assure voters that interest groups would have no say in a new Democrat White House. As for those interest groups themselves, he knew he could insult them with impunity. They had nowhere else to go in the cherished logic of Democratic centrism. And in fact, it's hard to think of major Clinton initiatives which were not counter-scheduling. NAFTA, ending welfare as we know it, dropping the capital gains rates, tough on crime crap, all of it designed to show that he was willing to tell core interest groups like labor unions and racial justice activists and the like to go to hell. And you know what? While morally, it was pretty repugnant and has over decades turned the Democratic Party into a principle-free heap that accomplishes little and routinely loses winnable elections, in a lot of ways, it was a smart short-term strategy. Certainly worked well enough to get Clinton reelected, because in the end, what other choice did the left have but to suck it up and vote for Bill? The alternative was just too bad. And after years in the political wilderness, DC embraced the screw-the-left approach to politics as the way that serious-minded people go about the business of winning. Oh, and it didn't hurt that all the moneyed interests that increasingly run this town and fund campaigns absolutely loved the approach, after all. What's not to love? Now financial elites have two parties fighting to do their bidding. And while Obama was stylistically different, he too believed in the counter-scheduling approach to politics. You don't bring in Rahm Emanuel as chief of staff, reject even a public option, and routinely fight for a grand bargain to cut Social Security if you're interested in exciting the left. And of course, one of Obama's favorite pastimes was lecturing black folks about respectability, famously telling a mostly black audience to stop feeding their children cold Popeyes for breakfast. That's to say nothing of his embrace of drones and surveillance, of course. Counter-scheduling is the core value of the Democratic Party establishment, and it is the core tenet of Joe Biden's political philosophy.
Here's Caitlin Johnstone. Never Biden isn't privileged. Supporting the status quo is. Privileged is the word of the day, with liberal narrative managers using their massive platforms to shame and berate anyone who says they're not going to vote for presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden in November. MSNBC's Joy Reid recently made headlines by teaming up with Al Jazeera's Mehdi Hasan to dogpile progressive commentator Kyle Kulinski on Twitter for saying he refused to support Biden and was fine with Democrats blaming him for a Trump re-election. We talked about that a couple of days ago. What this kind of thing says to me is that these are not left-wing voters. They are privileged white voters who demand to be bowed down to, no different than Trump's voters want those who are not white and Christian to take the knee for them, like in the good old days, Reid tweeted Monday evening. That is just evil. These are voters whose primary concern is that everyone else kneel. That's it, kneel. Or they threaten the rest of us with the endless torment of Trumpism, caged children, viral death, poverty, want, voter suppression, Muslim bans. Of course, none of this harms or impacts them. Well, here is reality, Reid continued. No one is going to kneel. Those who get the danger of Trumpism are going to vote and find enough fellow voters committed to doing the right thing. The danger to living, breathing people is real. Most don't have the luxury to pout over their preferred candidate. We already shared the Glenn Greenwald tweet. I continue to find it genuinely bizarre that wealthy and well-connected media pundits and DC operatives log onto Twitter or go on cable news on a daily basis to scream at young, debt-ridden, working-class and/or lower-income people that they are privileged for not cheering Biden. There are two problems with this privileged narrative. The first being that it is objectively false. As The Intercept's Glenn Greenwald explained in an article published last week, those who participate in America's two-party voting performance are overwhelmingly richer and whiter than those who decline to participate, with a comprehensive Pew Research Center survey finding that non-voters were more likely to be younger, less educated, less affluent, and non-white. Which makes sense. Wealthy Americans have two mainstream parties which represent their interests to an extent that is directly proportionate to their wealth, while everyone else is aware to a greater or lesser extent that they do not. And that is the second problem with the refusing to support Biden is a sign of privilege narrative. Not only is it objectively false, but the exact opposite is true. Refusing to participate in a system you know doesn't serve you is not a sign of privilege. A sign of privilege is feeling that you can afford to continue to support a status quo which murders, exploits, and oppresses disadvantaged groups at home and abroad, regardless of which party's sock puppet occupies the White House. World Socialist website accurately described the privileged nature of Biden's oligarchic support base after Barack Obama endorsed his former Veep. One should recall that Obama's selection of Biden as his running mate following the 2008 primary campaign was a gesture from Obama to the ruling class, an assurance that despite his anti-war posturing and hope and change rhetoric, there would be no encroachment on the wealth and privilege of the oligarchy, nor an end to U.S. imperialist wars. Or as Biden put it himself when speaking to major party donors at a 2019 New York fundraiser for his presidential run, under a Biden administration, nothing would fundamentally change. American privilege. U.S. liberals and progressives talk a bit about white privilege, male privilege, etc., but never American privilege, which is the ability their nationality gives them to have a very different relationship with the world than the rest of us. If you can't see it, there's a monster truck smashing a whole bunch of cars underneath it. The argument that refusing to support the Democratic Party nominee is a sign of privilege is premised on a fundamental misconception about the reality of America's two-party system. Its exponents believe that there are two separate parties, a really awful and abusive one, and another one which, while imperfect, is still a suitable vehicle for protecting vulnerable communities from the abuses of the other. That's the theory. In practice, what you actually get is one party with two distinct yet inseparable faces using a good cop, bad cop routine to advance the interests of the billionaire class which controls them both. From Bush to Obama to Trump, Americans have seen a two-headed one-party system consistently advance Orwellian government intrusiveness and destructive neoliberal agendas at home and murderous world-dominating military agendas abroad without missing a beat. Hell, Obama's deportation numbers are still greater than Trump's, but Trump has certainly continued and expanded the murderous foreign policies of his predecessors. It's been an unbroken legacy of slaughter and brutality, regardless of who's in office. When Tanzanian President Julius Nyerere was accused by the U.S. of running a one-party state in the 1960s, he famously said, "The United States is also a one-party state, but, with typical American extravagance, they have two of them." When you really grasp this truth, you become incapable of ever seeing two separate American political parties again. What you actually see is a single giant monster beating you with both fists while telling you it will beat you harder if you don't clap whenever it hits you with its left hand. "Clap for my left hand while I beat you, or I'll take abortions away from women," bellows the monster. "Clap for my left hand while I beat you, or I'll take civil rights away from minorities." What is the correct response to being assaulted by such a beast? Is it to placate it and do as it commands? Is it to say, "Oh yes, monster man, I'll do whatever you want to get you to abuse me with a little bit less ferocity"? Or is it to fight back? Is it to turn and face the beast and say, "Actually, no, you don't get to abuse anyone at all. You don't get to bully anyone into applauding their own abuse. You don't get to threaten to assault disadvantaged groups to bully me into supporting what you're doing. No." If you belong to a privileged group that is more insulated from the abuses of the monster, you will be less inclined to stand your ground and fight it. Are you listening, comfy Dems? If you are less privileged, you've got a lot less to lose by bringing the fight out into the open. But how do we defeat this monster? Simply not voting for Biden is obviously an insufficient and impotent gesture in and of itself. People refused to elect Hillary Clinton in 2016, and the party remained utterly unchanged in every meaningful way. This is because, for all their huffing and puffing, those who control the Democratic Party do not actually care about losing to Trump. They know they'll maintain their status and privilege, win or lose, so long as they successfully protect the political paradigm upon which that status and privilege are premised. So what can be done? Well, for starters, we've got to awaken Americans to the reality that they do not live in the kind of nation they were taught about in school. The two-headed, one-party monster demands that people clap for its left-armed abuses because it needs to keep the public plugged into the illusion that they live in a democracy and the status quo reflects the will of the electorate. This is precisely the illusion we need to awaken people from if we're ever to attain a critical mass of people forcing real change. For what appears to be a limited window of time, the public has an unprecedented ability to network and share information in the democratized information ecosystem afforded by the internet and social media. It's a highly imperfect medium, but it's the best tool we've got for sharing the truth about the reality of our situation, which is why so much effort is going into closing that window via increasingly ham-fisted internet censorship. She's right about that. That's why we need to share the fuck out of the leftist pundits and YouTubers. The oligarch-owned political/media class continually spouts propaganda geared toward manufacturing the consent of the governed for our exploitative, oppressive, murderous, and ecocidal status quo. So our job is to shatter people's trust in the narratives being promulgated by that political/media class. Awakening from the establishment narrative matrix to the reality of what's actually going on is extremely uncomfortable because it immediately brings on a tremendous disgust and dissatisfaction with what the two-headed monster is doing to us. This is a good thing, not a bad thing. It means that anyone we awaken to the reality of our situation and the lies we've been told about it will also experience the same disgust and dissatisfaction, which will in turn drive them to help awaken others, who will in turn be driven to awaken others, and so on. The potential for exponential growth is here. But again, that window is closing. We've got to strike while the iron is hot. Dear listeners and viewers, we've got to strike while we still can.